Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Robert McGuire, number 37134, and along with my colleague Jeffrey Baines, we represent the appellant Marilyn Marks, who was the respondent below. At the outset, I'd just like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That will be up to you, Judge.
Thank you, Robert.
You get the yellow light at 5 minutes.
Thank you. This case asks whether the district court properly construed the Colorado Open Records Act to allow a custodian to take a member of the public to court under Section 204.6a, litigate the case to the brink of a hearing, and then abandon the claim, turn over the public record that had been requested, and walk away, leaving a member of the public saddled with the legal bills that should have been fee shifted to a custodian who did not prevail.
Mr. McGuire, is abandon really a fair term given that the parties entered into a voluntary stay pending legislation that was pending before the Colorado legislature?
Yes. Abandon is proper because at the time the stay was entered into, and just if I may consult my timeline here, the hearing was initially set for December 1st. It was vacated due to a disclosure by the custodian, and then it was reset for March 23rd. As that day approached, a bill was introduced in the Colorado legislature that would have addressed explicitly whether ballots were subject to inspection and what the terms were. At that time, the custodian came to our client and asked our client to essentially put the case on pause so that we could see what happened with the legislation. And the reason why that was significant is because the legislation initially barred the inspection of ballots. So there's nothing constitutional about the right to inspect ballots under CORA. It's a creature of statute. And so given that there was legislation in place, there was legislation in motion that would have completely barred the inspection of ballots, my client would have rather waited to see if that was enacted rather than have it be enacted after she had gone through the trouble of litigating a case, waiting for a judgment, and then have the legislature bar the inspection of ballots. Now, that's not ultimately what happened. Ultimately, what happened is the legislature adopted a bill and the governor signed it that allowed for the inspection of ballots under certain conditions. We don't believe, in our position in front of the district court and our position in our briefing, has been consistent that law didn't change anything. We already had a court of appeals case, Marks v. Cook, in which images of ballots were subject to inspection under CORA, and the court of appeals confirmed that the content of the ballot, the face of the ballot, the photographic image of the ballot can be inspected, provided that it's not traceable to an individual voter. And the determination there is in the hands of the clerk, in the discretion of the clerk as to whether a particular ballot should be produced or not. That was in place before this case began, and so there was no question that the law allowed the inspection of ballots. The fact that the parties, in the interest of judicial economy, put the case in a suspended mode, pending legislation that would have affected the outcome if it had barred ballots from being inspected, did not amount, certainly from our side, to any kind of concession that that the issues were at all in flux or that the denial was proper. So I think, Your Honors, this case is basically decidable on the basis of two different independent exercises of statutory construction. And the district court, we believe, erred in giving construction to both subsection 204.6 and subsection 204.5 of CORA. The hearing was held essentially after the case was brought back to life. There was a status conference on June 22nd of 2012. At which the parties set a hearing solely for the purpose of determining the entitlement to fees. And between that June 22nd status conference and the hearing on fees, the record was produced. The ballot was produced to Ms. Marks. She was allowed to inspect it. And essentially, there was nothing else at issue on merits. So when the fee hearing came, what the custodian did is the custodian came to the district court and essentially argued, after having briefed these issues on the basis that the inspection of ballots should be prohibited. She then came to court on September 27th of 2012 and argued that despite the fact that she briefed that the inspection should be prohibited, she came to court and argued that she was uncertain all along as to whether or not inspection should be prohibited or allowed. And so the gist of the whole September 27th argument was not whether Ms. Marks would be entitled to her fees if the custodian, it was not whether Ms. Marks would be entitled to her fees if the custodian wasn't uncertain, but rather was the custodian's position that she was uncertain, and therefore this exception in 2046A applied to fee shifting. And in fact, at the beginning of that hearing, if you look at the transcript of the September 27th hearing, at the beginning, the county attorney actually acknowledges that there is fee shifting under subsection 2046A unless the custodian is able to prove that she was uncertain about what the law required. So they actually had the same position that we have now at the outset of that hearing, and the district court adopted a different construction of 2046A, which we believe was an error. And so the first exercise of statutory construction is looking at the exception to fees in subsection 2046A. And as we've argued in our brief, the existence of an exception to a rule implies the rule. And that's a simple function of statutory construction. It makes no sense to exclude something from a rule if there is no rule. And so the fact that there is an exclusion from paying attorney fees in subsection 2046A, when the custodian is able to prove their uncertainty and the trial court makes a finding that they were uncertain, implies that in all other circumstances, there is fee shifting in accordance with subsection 2045.
Have you examined the legislative history for support for any of your arguments?
Yes, there's not a lot of it included in the briefing in this case, but it has been batted around quite a bit. The Benefield case, which was decided by the Court of Appeals and had been at issue here, the briefings in the Benefield case were heavily focused on the legislative history of the fee shifting under CORA. And in fact, we were familiar with it because we were initially part of the group that was going to be filing amicus in that case. And we did not ultimately file it, but we have looked into the legislative history, and I think we certainly can submit supplemental authority if the court would value it. But otherwise, I would just simply represent that the legislative history surrounding the fee-shifting provisions of CORA very clearly indicate that the purpose of the sponsor, which was Representative Sean Mitchell, was to ensure that if a member of the public has to litigate against the government and ultimately winds up getting a record, the government is going to have to pay that person's litigation expenses.
Is there any reference in the legislative history to what the briefs call the catalyst theory?
In the briefs in this case,
no, right? Is there any reference in the legislative history to what the briefs in this case call the catalyst theory?
Not that I'm aware of, no. The catalyst theory is a FOIA doctrine adopted by the federal courts to govern FOIA, and it essentially deals with the fact that if the person goes to court to compel a federal agency to produce a federal record, then and the federal agency produces the record in response to the litigation, then that person can be said to have been a catalyst for the production of the record. It's a bad fit for this case because CORA has this feature whereby in 6A the custodian can come to court. And so the catalyst feature doesn't exactly fit very well because the custodian would be the one catalyzing something, and it's unclear what exactly that would be when the custodian ultimately gets into the theory of the person requesting the record.
So, pardon me for interrupting, Mr. McGuire, but as I understand your argument, the catalyst theory really is a red herring, because at least the federal catalyst cases proceed from the following assumption. Individual sues government. There is eventually some resolution shy of court. And before Buchanan, the result of that was you could get fees. But in this case, you're saying that it wasn't individual goes to court and files case, and thus there should be some sort of catalyst approach. You're saying government went to court to bar individual. And so am I understanding you correctly to say that the catalyst theory is a red herring here?
That's correct. We don't think the catalyst theory has a whole lot of purpose here because the statutory language itself gets rid of any need for us to look behind and come up with a import a judicially created doctrine under FOIA. The language of CORA is very clear. Section 204.5 says that fees are mandatory unless the court finds that withholding was proper. There is no discretion for the district court. It's a simple, it's a binary issue.
So your position would be once the custodian goes into court to block production, as opposed to saying, judge, help me, I can't figure this out, either the custodian wins or the custodian loses and pays fees. That's the binary choice.
That's correct.
Okay, but here there was, the problem is here there was no winner, but as determined by the court.
Well, that's true, but I think that the fact that the court didn't issue an order is correct. The fact that there was no winner is, I think, incorrect, because Ms. Marks clearly prevailed.
Well, she got something of what she asked for, but not everything. She didn't get what she asked for originally.
Well, she got everything that was at issue in the case. There were two CORA requests, but only one was the subject of the litigation.
What's your basis for that statement?
Well, the transcript of the various hearings, Your Honor, there was really only one request which was at issue. It was the request for a single ballot. Ms. Marks initially came in and said she wanted to request some ballots and inspect some ballots. And the clerk got back to her and said, it's a busy time. Our office can't handle that right now. And so Ms. Marks came back very clearly and said in a second CORA request, well, then I just want to inspect this particular ballot, the first one in this box and in this stack, and we'll deal with the rest of it later. And so clearly that was a superseding CORA request. Now, there's some controversy in the briefing as to whether it was a superseding CORA request or not, but if you look at the transcript, the June 22nd transcript, page 10, lines 5 to 6, page 19, lines 24 to 25, the county attorney on page 20, line 9 to 11, page 21, line 5, and of course in the September 27th transcript, the court itself, at page 79, line 20 through page 80, line 1, everyone recognized we were talking about the second CORA request. That was the only CORA request that anyone was talking about throughout all the proceedings in this case.
So the first one isn't an issue before us?
The first one is not an issue before us. And I think the dispute between the parties was over whether it was superseding or not, was whether Ms. Marks had retracted. Her position is she hadn't retracted it, but that it wasn't an issue in this case. And it certainly wasn't anything that anybody talked about in the case. Once the case had gotten started.
Mr. McGuire, as I understand your definition of prevailing, because she obtained the ballot in the end, she prevailed. But that's hard to square with the language of the statute that requires a finding by the court. Under your definition, it seems there has to be some causative connection between her email requests and the fact that she got a ballot. But the undisputed testimony was that the ballot was disclosed because of the legislation.
Well, I think you have to read Section 204.5 and Section 204.6a together. And what 204.5 requires in the fee shifting provision is it says the fee shifting is mandatory unless there is a finding, an affirmative finding, that the withholding was proper. That did not happen here. And because that did not happen here, that unless clause essentially, the application of that unless clause means that fee shifting is mandatory. And there are two parts, incidentally, to that provision in 204.5. The first part says that unless there's a finding that the withholding is proper, the judge has to enter an order requiring disclosure of the document. Now, that didn't happen here, just as it didn't happen in Benefield. Okay? It didn't happen because it wasn't necessary, because the document had already been turned over. But the Court of Appeals in Benefield said there's no legal significance to the fact that there isn't an order, because an order is practically unnecessary. But if you look at the language of the statute requires that unless you have a finding that the withholding is proper, which did not happen here, the court is under an obligation. It shall issue an order providing that the record should be disclosed. And that order would have made Ms. Marks a prevailing party, even under the formal standard of having to obtain an order. So to the extent that there was no order, effectively what the district court did is it bootstrapped itself into saying that Ms. Marks wasn't a prevailing party by neglecting to do its duty to issue an order that would have made her a prevailing party. So our position is that Ms. Marks, by not, and it's important also to recognize in this context, that the burden of proof in a CORA case, whether it's under 204.5 or 204.6a, is placed squarely on the custodian. So if the custodian fails to meet a burden, and the result is no finding, and the finding is a necessity to avoid attorney fees, our view is that attorney fees have to be mandatory. under the plain language of the statute.
As I read the transcript, though, the only evidence presented was by the custodian of records, and she testified that the cause of disclosing the ballot was the legislation. As I understand, that wasn't rebutted. Is that correct?
I think it wasn't rebutted for two reasons. One, I'm not sure that it was that was certainly their position, but our position was that the law already required ballots to be inspected. We already had Marks v. Cook. We already had House Bill 1036, which was a matter of law, and we had an election advisory from the Secretary of State's office, which all said ballots are inspectable. And so, therefore, the fact that she produced the ballot in response to the law, if anything, just serves to highlight that her withholding in the first place was improper. And so, therefore, Ms. Marks should have gotten it, and there never should have been a withholding. I see my time is up. Unless there are further questions, I would like to ask, may I have 30 seconds potentially to rebut, or I guess it would depend on the course.
It would depend on the course. We'll see how you're responding.
Thank you very much. Sure.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Davis. I'm the Shady County Attorney 25072. I represent Dresdner now in official capacity as the Shady County Clerk and Recorder. I'd like to start with addressing whether both requests were at issue in this case, both court requests. And there was never a hearing on the merits of this case, so there was never an opportunity to be discussing both requests, and the county's position is that both requests clearly were at issue in the case. The petition was filed with both court requests attached. The trial court judge made findings with respect to both requests, so we certainly take issue with that. And originally, until the clerk did decide to rely on the passage of 1036 for guidance as to how she would respond to the disclosure, she was seeking guidance on both those issues, and the record clearly reflects that Ms. Marks took the position at the trial court level that those were two separate requests, and that she was reserving the rights to come back to the county on the first request. The catalyst theory was mentioned in my brief because I was projecting that that would be the only theory that Ms. Marks would be able to argue that she was a prevailing party, that somehow through the litigation, the county was prompted to make the disclosure through the litigation. And so that's why I addressed the catalyst theory in the brief and then dismissed that as not applying because the language in court is different than the language in the federal law that talks about a substantially prevailing party. The court does not talk about a substantially prevailing party. It requires a prevailing party, which, as I tried to explain in the brief, was a rejection of the catalyst theory. I want to get, I want to backtrack a little to standard of review in this case. As you know, the parties have a difference of opinion on the standard of review. We are viewing this case as a case involving a mixed question of law and fact. There was a case that I probably should have cited that I did not on the standard of review that I discovered this morning, and that case is U470 over Highway Authority. It's at 3P3rd 18. Colorado 2000. And that case specifies in a case involving mixed questions of law and fact, the Court of Appeals has an option as to what standard to apply. It can treat the ultimate conclusions from the fact and apply the clear error standard. It can treat the entire matter as de novo review, or it can review the findings of fact for clear error and still look de novo at the legal conclusions, which was the position that I had taken in my brief before the court. I would ask that the court should look at this, the findings of fact, for clear error because there was substantial records supporting the trial court's findings in this case. I'd also like to touch on the burden of proof. The parties also disagree with the burden of proof in this matter. Ms. Marks asserts that the clerk has the duty of proving that Ms. Marks is not entitled to attorney's fees. However, the case law is established that the party seeking an award of fees bears the burden of establishing an entitlement to those fees. And there's two cases, Anderson v. Secretary and Anderson v. Purcell, that are cited in my brief. I'd like to turn to the argument that 12-10-36 did nothing to change the law. I believe that just on the fit, you know, reading through the law, it's clear that it did change the law. Prior to House Bill 12-10-36, there was absolutely no guidance to clerks as to what constituted an unidentifiable ballot. When the Cook case came out, it talks about whether a ballot is identifiable on its face. As came out in this case, there are numerous situations where a ballot may appear to not be identifiable on its face, but through reference to other documents, a ballot may be identifiable. For instance, the clerk testified that there was a large number of write-in candidates in the 2010 general election. Raises the question whether handwriting enters and a ballot anonymous on its face. There's marks that can be placed on a ballot that might appear to be innocuous but are used to carry out election fraud. There was absolutely no guidance as to whether that type of ballot can be withheld in a FOIA request. And then there's the issue if a ballot is traceable because of a particular ballot style, and there's only a few electors that voted that particular ballot style at a certain vote center through reference of various documents, it could be possible to determine a particular voter for that particular ballot. So those are all issues that the clerk had, questions that she had. The Coke case had came out, I believe, 6 business days prior to the open records request, the first open records request that Ms. Marks presented to the county. And that was the first time that there was even a thought that a voted ballot could be open to the public. So of course the clerk did not have procedures to address these types of situations, nor did she know how to go about drafting procedures to address that. And the trial court found that it was reasonable for the court not, or for the clerk rather, to not have procedures in place because of the timing issues.
Does the statute resolve any of the ambiguities that you raised?
It does.
You know, such as the handwriting identification?
It does. It clearly, specifically allows for redaction of any markings that may identify a particular elector who cast that ballot. So it would allow the clerk to redact a handwritten name that was put in onto the ballot. It specifically allows ballots such as military and overseas ballots to be excluded if the disclosure could result in the ballot being identified. And then I think most telling, it specifically allows ballots to be excluded when the combination of precincts and ballot styles results in 9 or fewer ballots, even if the ballots are not identifiable on the face of the ballot. So that clearly gives some guidance to the clerk as to how she can respond, and should respond to those questions.
Pardon me, Ms. Davis, but it sounds to me like these are all arguments that a clerk would make under a subsection 6A argument, saying, you know, I don't know. This is risky. There are problems here. There could be the risk of disclosure of voter identity, which is a bad thing. Why not come in under that?
We attempted to, and that was, I'll admit that the language of the petition that I originally filed was not artful, and there is language in there that says that she was unsure. Actually, I believe that the language that said that she was unsure how to respond was in my email to Ms. Marks telling her we were filing this petition because the clerk was unsure.
Pardon me, I'm sorry, but was it in the pleading that you filed with the court?
That language was not in the pleading, which is why the court would not let us in under the safe harbor when we were at the trial level arguing for attorney's fees. Because I didn't have that language in the petition, rather it was in the email. My intent was to sort of plead in an alternative, to argue that we did not know how to disclose, and that in the event that the judge felt that we did need to disclose, to wait until after the election before the clerk had to disclose, because the clerk had an election going, a new election going on at the time that these requests were being met. There was also, I'm sorry, the request that if they were ordered to be disclosed, that they not be disclosed because it would it would contravene the public interest in their case. So those were the alternatives that the clerk was looking for. Again, the judge did not accept our argument that we were trying to argue that we did not know how to disclose or were uncertain of how to make that disclosure. But the court went on, and again, I want to emphasize that there was never a hearing on the merits of that issue. So we never had an opportunity. We were going to bring in, both sides were going to bring in expert witnesses that would address the issue of whether there would be against the public interest to have a disclosure. So we never did reach that issue. We were arguing it in the, again, at the hearing on attorney's fees for the purpose of trying to establish that Ms. Reno had brought the petition in good faith.
Well, are you asking us to reverse the lower court's finding that this wasn't a safe harbor case? And if so, what's our scope of review?
No, we did not brief that issue.
So this is not a safe harbor case.
That's right. Period. The trial court found that it was not a safe harbor case. He was specific on that, and I did not appeal that issue. I had not read the Benfield case prior to filing the petition, which talked about having to have that safe harbor language in the petition itself.
Well, okay. If this is not a safe harbor case, then how do you respond to Ms. Mark's assertion that that leaves only a binary choice? Either the clerk wins because the judge says you don't have to turn it over, or the clerk pays fees. Where is there another alternative in the statutory language?
I don't think that binary choice follows the language in Benefield. Benefield requires that there first be a prevailing party, and that's where this court needs to start. Was there a prevailing party? And our response to that is no, there was not.
Okay, and why wasn't there?
Because Benefield requires, I'm sorry.
Well, let me try to make it easier for you. Is there not a prevailing party because there's no court order, or is there not a prevailing party because the clerk gave Mrs. Marks something less than 100% of what she asked for?
First of all, there's not a prevailing party because there was no court order. The partial disclosure, I'm not arguing that as well. I know that's had issue in Benfield, but there's a second piece to that. Besides having to obtain an order in order to be a prevailing party under the language of Benfield, you have to bring an action under 204.5, which didn't occur, and you have to obtain the record as a result of the action. It's the as a result of the action that didn't happen in this case. The Ms. Marks obtained one of the requested documents not as a result of an action either brought by her or brought by the clerk. Rather, she obtained the document because there was an intervening change of the law. And my brief cites various jurisdictions that talk about that with respect to whether you can be a prevailing party when there's a change in an intervening change in the statute. So we believe that under the language of Benefield, those three elements were not met.
And I'm not going to say this as well as Mrs. Mark's lawyer, but how then do you respond to the hypothetical question of a clerk or a custodian could always beat the requester out of fees by commencing an action and then giving the requester enough that the requester would go away before there's entry of an order?
I think that that would only happen if there's going to be where a unscrupulous custodian could sort of fudge around and just take them to court without, in order to weed out people that don't have the money to
But isn't that a real risk, and isn't mitigation of that risk why fee-shifting provisions are in statutes that pit government, the government against the private citizen?
I do not believe that it's a risk in this case, because what we're talking about, what happened in this case is, first of all, there wasn't, Ms. Marks is not an applicant, so there was no application that she filed. Now under six, the reason why this is different is because the document was obtained because of an intervening statute. So the only time this issue is going to arise is if there's been intervening legislation. There could always be a court finding that the clerk disclosed the document not because of an intervening statute, but because she was trying to burden the requester. And we have just the opposite finding here. So there, in an attorney's fees hearing, there would be an opportunity for the constituent to obtain that finding from the court that clearly the clerk was just trying to delay the production of the document. And plus, there's language in CORA that requires the hearing be time limited. I'm trying to find the exact language, but it requires that the hearing be forthwith. And so that language as well would not allow a clerk to delay producing the document, because if she's bringing an action under subsection 6, the hearing must take place right away and there wouldn't be much delay going on. If she turned over the document and, you know, right before the hearing, there would be no finding of good faith on the clerk's part because there has been no intervening legislation. In this case, our position is that it's the intervening legislation that makes that prevents Ms. Marks from being a prevailing applicant. And it's that factor, as well as the factor that the court found that the clerk was acting in good faith in bringing the case. And there could always be a court finding that the clerk was not acting in good faith when bringing the case. And that's what would prevent abuse of the statute. And there's also, you know, Rule 11, there could be a finding that the action was frivolous. There could be abuse of process claims. Those are all mechanisms that exist in the law that would prevent a clerk from being unscrupulous and bringing frivolous actions just to delay an hour.
I believe your time is exhausted, and since you ran over, I will give your opponent a minute or less to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor. I really have just one point in closing, and that is that a denial of a right to inspect is either proper or improper when it happens. So in this case, that was in October of 2011. The legislature was not in session. House Bill 1036 was probably just a glimmer in its sponsor's eye at that point. There was no reason to think that House Bill 1036 should affect whether or not this denial was proper or improper when it occurred. So the fact that there was intervening legislation, while it may have motivated the clerk to ultimately surrender her position, it has no bearing on the merits of her position in the first place. And that is what CORA looks to, whether the denial was proper when it was done.
But your client agreed to postpone any decision in the case pending the legislation. So obviously your client recognized that could be a game changer.
Indeed. I mean, my client has been very interested in settling these cases. She was hailed into court, and her intention was not to continue spending money litigating something that might be resolved conclusively in her favor for reasons other than the initial merits of the case by the legislature. And I think the judicial policy of the state is to encourage settlement and to encourage parties to resolve their differences to the extent they can without the involvement of the court. And I think my client's intention in suspending the case and agreeing to suspend the case was certainly not to abandon her fee claim or to surrender or to somehow concede her position of merits. Rather, her entire purpose was to economize and hopefully reach a resolution without having to spend any more money.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused, and Ms. Davis, we apologize that we could not make your telephone request work, but it may be viable in the future.